So it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Professor Robert Howes, who is the Lloyd C. Nelson Professor of Law at New York University. Professor Howes is one of the most well-known and globally admired scholars of contemporary international law, and I think almost unique in his ability, unique in the field in terms of the range of his interests, the breadth of his expertise, and his equal fluency across technical, theoretical, critical, pragmatic idioms. He is equally comfortable discussing the finer points of the most recent WTO appellate body decision, the upcoming COP21 in Paris, or Alexander Kohev's outline of a phenomenology of right. Some of you will know of his work in international trade investment law, where he is the co-author of one of the leading textbooks on the law of the World Trade Organization, as well as one of its most insightful critics and commentators. And in that field, he clearly ranks alongside Jackson and Hudek in his influence and impact. Others of you will know him through his most recent book, Leo Strauss, Man of Peace, which offers a new reading of Strauss's views on themes of war, violence, and law, provocative to many who know Strauss' writings only through their enlistment in recent decades by some members of the UN foreign policy establishment. That book has been described as the new standard by which books on Strauss are measured. Professor Howes has also, and I say this with admiration, embraced new means for the dissemination of academic research and engagement with the public, writing insightfully for blogs as well as other social media platforms. I learned a great deal about the Iran nuclear deal in the days after it was announced by reading closely Professor Howes's blog posts on various aspects of the deal. And of course, that's the subject of tonight's talk, the Iran deal and the future of American foreign policy doctrine, power, law, ideology, and partisanship. We're looking forward to it immensely, and we're grateful to you, Rob, for your time and expertise.
Thanks so very much, Andrew. I should first of all say that it's a great pleasure to be here at the LSC Law Department as a visiting fellow this term, and many thanks to Andrew and his colleagues for making this opportunity possible and making it as rich and enjoyable as it has turned out to be. I want to begin with a number of caveats and disclosures. The topic that I'm going to speak about, while I did put, I think, law in the subtitle, is probably not immediately obvious as a legal topic, but I'm going to try and persuade you that the question of the future of American foreign policy doctrine, and indeed the way in which the fight in the United States over whether to go forward with the Iran deal or not played itself out, had a lot to do with law, and particularly what one might call background or rules of law, both international and domestic, constitutional and public law. And in fact, as we'll see, one of the reasons that the opponents of the deal or the leaders of the opposition to the deal actually failed was, in fact, that they didn't properly understand the impact of some of these rules on the unfolding of events and the power relations in political bargaining. And that's something that, you know, that I'll come to. Secondly, I want to be very clear that even though my purpose here is more analysis than critique, that I was a strong supporter of the deal. Andrew mentioned one of my blog posts. I blogged a lot, and I was quite critical of its opponents. That being said, I also want to say that for many people, or at least some people, One of the central disturbing features of this whole story was the involvement of the State of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and lobbyists supportive of the Israeli government in this whole controversy. My own view is that that wasn't necessarily in itself inappropriate, and that the use of those facts and also the notion that one should support one, that supporting the deal somehow meant that one was pro Netanyahu opposing it, you know, that identification I want to question, because in fact dozens of very senior military and security officials in Israel who served at the highest levels in numerous Israeli governments representing very different political parties actually came out supporting the Iran deal. So there was no monolithic view against the deal by the Israeli military and security establishment. I also understand why many people felt somewhat insecure in Israel, because after all, Israel was not a party. And so I think there was a sense on the part of many people who didn't perhaps understand the details very well that an agreement was being negotiated that would directly affect their security, and yet they weren't at the negotiating table. Now, that was probably in many ways the fault of the Netanyahu government itself, but that's, you know, another long story. All this is to say that this is, I think, a positive story about the success of diplomacy and the ultimate triumph of reason in the U.S. domestic political debate, but it's not an anti-Israeli story, and I think that spinning it in that way is a mistake, as some people have in fact done. So, around 2003, the unlikely team of Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida wrote a piece in the wake of the Iran war suggesting that a very considerable gulf was occurring between American and European approaches to foreign policy, and that indeed the need for a common European foreign policy was pressing because, Habermas and Derrida argued, the United States was going down a path that was inimical to common European values. This was the Bush administration after 9/11, a path of the unilateral use of force, a sense that America's supposed moral superiority entitled it to project force on its own in support of exceptionalist American values, a contempt for the rule of law, for multilateral diplomacy, and so forth. And the implication of this letter by Habermas and Derrida was that this was more than simply one group of officials in one particular administration, the Bush administration, but that something more fundamental was at issue in terms of a divide in foreign policy outlook between the United States and Europe. Now, when President Obama came into office, it's quite clear that in some respects he diverged from that outcome. The United States did not bomb Libya until, or really engage in active military operations against Gaddafi, until there was a Security Council resolution. The U.S. Worked within the Security Council framework, and there was a resolution. Therefore, unlike the Iraq episode, whether one could debate as a matter of policy whether the results in Libya were desirable or disastrous, but nevertheless, those results were produced in accordance with the UN Charter framework, which gave the Security Council the ability to authorize the use of force by members of the United Nations. The administration, in the case of Syria, resisted even calls from Democrats, people close to the administration itself and in it, to use force, except as a very much a last resort, and instead try to get some kind of agreement with Assad to the non-use of weapons of mass destruction. And of course, that agreement probably, you know, now we know was not exactly honored to the letter. Nevertheless, there seemed to be a deviation of approach. But the question again would be whether that deviation was very specific or peculiar to Obama. Last winter, I believe, Jacob Heilbrun, editor of an important U.S. foreign policy magazine, The National Interest, wrote an article suggesting, in fact, that the people who had produced the unilateralist anti-rule of law approach or outlook described by Habermas and Derrida were making a comeback, the so-called neoconservatives. And so this would indeed support the Habermas-Derrida thesis that something, you know, there was something fundamental here about this outlook endemic to what one might call the overlapping consensus of American foreign policy, and that it wasn't an exceptionalism produced by the psychic wounds of 9/11 combined with the accident of the kinds of personalities who found themselves in high office in the Bush administration. Heilbrun pointed to a number of recent data points to the apparent public displeasure at Obama's foreign policy, the sense that Obama was failing in Iraq, Afghanistan, elsewhere, to rumors that Hillary Clinton was actually herself being advised by some people who could be described as neoconservatives. And perhaps above all, and this is a good place to begin our story about the fight over the Iran deal, an individual called Tom Cotton, who was elected as a senator from Arkansas. Now, Cotton could be described as the arch neoconservative. He went to Harvard and Harvard Law School. He became a protege of William Kristol, a leading figure in the one generation older neoconservatives. And Kristol was one of those who had constructed this or fabricated this kind of image of the philosopher Leo Strauss as an arch warmonger. An image that I've tried to show in my book, Leo Strauss' Man of Peace, that Andrew mentioned, is not supported by Strauss's works. To give you an example of the way in which Kristol distorted Strauss's writings, there's a very clear example from a piece that he wrote just months ago attacking Obama's foreign policy as weak, where he quoted a line from Leo Strauss that justice without a sword is contemptible. Now, what was Strauss referring to when he referred to the sorry spectacle, quote unquote, of justice without a sword? If you go and look up the quotation, it has nothing to do with being upset about a lack of hawkishness or aggressiveness in foreign policy. Strauss was referring to the failure of the Weimar Republic to be able to effectively use its police power to suppress extremism, particularly on the political right, which gave the Nazi movement a window of opportunity. Again, the quotation taken entirely out of context and used for a purpose that suggests that Strauss had a set of values quite opposite to the values that actually inspired that statement of regret that the Weimar Republic was not able to suppress political extremism. And so Cotton was elected to the Senate in favor of a massive increase in U.S. military presence and activity in Iraq and Afghanistan, and basically entirely, you know, working within an intellectual frame wrongly attributed to Leo Strauss, but more plausibly attributed to, for example, some of you may know the Nazi legal and political theorist Carl Schmitt. So all of this led Heilbronn to suggest that we were on the verge of a significant, and the elections coming up too, in 2016. All this led Heilbronn to suggest that we were on the verge of a new neoconservative revival, and in fact that Obama may indeed have been a kind of exception, and that we were moving back to this outlook that that again Habermas and Derrida were so concerned about as deeply rooted in contemporary American political culture, one of unilateralism, use force early and often rather than as a last resort, and very sparingly characterize anyone who prefers diplomacy and negotiation to bombing as an appeaser or, you know, a Neville Chamberlain. You know, in the days before the Senate and the House took up the question of whether to approve the Iran deal, you know, there were hundreds of references in the neocon press to Neville Chamberlain and to Munich and so forth, as if, you know, the facts of Europe in 1939 and the facts about Iran in 2015 were essentially identical or on all fours. So when President Obama came into office, he made an effort to strengthen sanctions against Iran, which were targeted at its nuclear program, which many believed was designed to create the capacity to build and use nuclear weapons, even though Iran had consistently maintained that its objectives were purely those of a civil nuclear program, which under international law, Iran was perfectly within its rights to pursue. But Iran resisted, negotiating on this and resisted to a significant extent inspection and verification, resisted the regime of the International Atomic Energy Agency. So President Obama did something remarkable, which is he managed to get enough support from the permanent members of the Security Council to impose sanctions that were relatively watertight. And if some of you are wondering why an international trade law scholar would be so involved in this Iran issue, well, fundamentally, the issue about the Iran deal is an issue about sanctions, which is something that I've thought about and written about a great deal. Their strengths and weaknesses, their relationship to diplomacy and persuasion on the one hand, and the use of force on the other. So many of the loopholes were closed, and a monitoring and enforcement regime for sanctions that had some teeth was built into the new Security Council resolutions. But the backdrop to this was an increasing impatience on the part of the Israeli government that Iran's nuclear research and development activity was getting out of hand, and that it had the capacity to use the jargon, to break out fairly quickly and build a nuclear bomb, and that this was a threat to the very existence of Israel. So at a number of times, and we now have leaked materials about this, the Israeli security cabinet seriously considered a unilateral strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. For various reasons, in no case does it seem, well, obviously it wasn't done, but it came close to being ordered and may indeed in one case have been ordered. Now, here you need to know something a little technical, which is that, you know, if you talk privately, and I've done this for many years with people close to the Israeli military and the intelligence community, And this is now information that's, you know, widely known too, because this issue has been so thoroughly debated and discussed in the media, that given the capacity of Israeli planes and ordnance, the likelihood of significantly retarding Iran's nuclear program by such a strike would not be great. You know, it would be maybe 3 months, if you were extremely optimistic, 6 months. On the other hand, and I think this was well understood by the Israeli security and military community, intelligence community, it would be unlikely that such a strike would not provoke some kind of response from Iran. They would just say, "Oh, that was very nasty of you," and move on. So, what was the calculus? If Israel did it alone, it there was a high risk that they would achieve very little, but on the other hand, provoke some kind of military response. On the other hand, if they could persuade the United States to become involved, the scenario changed somewhat, because the United States was developing a bomb called the MOPS, MOPS, multiple ordnance something or other. Anyhow, this bomb has a much greater supposed capacity to break through heavily fortified and buried facilities. And my sense is that the Obama administration was very concerned that what Israel was calculating was that a unilateral strike might almost inevitably induce the United States to come back and use this weapon, which would really effectively do the job. Otherwise, you know, Israel's security would be, you know, further endangered, having provoked Iran by the initial and not particularly successful strike. There's even one rumor that at one point the Israeli cabinet came so close to ordering a strike that they were given a message from the Obama administration that if they tried to do so, the U.S. would scramble jets in order to intercept and, if necessary, shoot down the Israeli planes. I have no idea whether this is true, but it became widely leaked in papers in different countries, including in Arab countries in the Middle East. In any case, you know, Obama's strategy was tighten the sanctions. I don't think he ever believed that the sanctions would bring Iran to its feet. In other words, get it to stop its nuclear program entirely, because, after all, they had a point under international law that if their purpose was genuinely civil, that they were entitled to do it. But if it didn't bring them to their knees, if the political dynamics evolved in the right way in Iran, at least the sanctions might bring them to the negotiating table, which is precisely what happened and ultimately resulted in an interim agreement in 2013, which was then followed by further negotiations. Now, when the U.S. administration went forward with the effort to negotiate a final agreement on Iran's nuclear program, and let's be clear on what this agreement is about, and we don't have the time, and probably most of you don't have the interest to go through the technicalities, but basically the idea is to switch around, alter, modify, in some cases curtail, elements of Iran's purportedly civil research and development program so that the pathways to breaking out to a bomb are stopped, but yet Iran has a reasonable capacity to maintain and indeed even improve and modernize its program as a purely civil nuclear program. So that was the idea. Can we do this? Can we have enough safeguards, enough monitoring to ensure that all these modifications, these switcharounds and so on are going to do the job of stopping the pathways to a bomb while giving Iran the possibility of a viable modern civil nuclear program, which it's entitled to have, arguably, under international law. So that's really the goal. And so if Iran signed onto the agreement, it was going to get sanctions relief. That was the you know, that was the switch between using sanctions as a stick to using sanctions as a carrot. So sanctions were fundamentally behind the entire administration strategy on Iran's nuclear program. So when it becomes clear that the administration and Iran are prepared, and this had to do with political dynamics there, to go ahead and negotiate the final agreement, Netanyahu and his supporters in the U.S. went into high gear and realized that, you know, they had so far not been able to prevent any stage in these negotiations, and that it would be necessary to take significant steps in order to basically, halt the effort to move towards a final agreement. And the place to which Netanyahu appealed, and he flew over and talked to them, was the U.S. Congress, obviously dominated, and particularly the House of Representatives, overwhelmingly almost by Republicans, who were, many of them, if not most of them, a sympathetic audience. And one thing that they were successful at doing was making this a partisan issue. So it became essentially a requirement or an aspect of one's party loyalty as a Republican to oppose these negotiations, and then eventually to oppose the deal that came out of the negotiations. Now, perhaps this initial step was a mistake, to so heavily attack a deal that did not yet exist, because eventually when the opponents would have to argue against the deal that was negotiated, they would find themselves arguing that it should be rejected because a better deal was available. Yet their credibility in doing that was obviously limited, because people knew that they would be opposed to any agreement. They knew that because they were dogmatically and vehemently opposed to even negotiating the agreement. So how could they claim that what they were really after was a better agreement? But we're getting ahead of ourselves a little. So it becomes fairly clear that the negotiations are succeeding in the early spring of this year, 2015, and that it's very likely that a framework or a set of principles or parameters for a final deal will be agreed between Iran, the five members, permanent members of the Security Council, and Germany. It's here, at this point in time, that the opponents, and particularly Netanyahu and his closest American friends and political allies, decide that or look at for a leader, a political leader in the United States who will guide and become a focal point for the campaign against the agreement. And not surprisingly, it was none other than Senator Tom Cotton who presented himself for that role with considerable enthusiasm. And so Cotton managed to get 46 senators to sign on to a letter to the leaders of Iran. And the letter basically said the following: "We think you don't understand the American constitutional and legal system." Now, of course, this was immensely condescending, first of all, because some of you may know, for example, the Iranian foreign minister, the lead person in the negotiations, Zarif, actually, I believe, has a PhD from an American university. But anyhow, basically the letter said that under the U.S. system of government, any agreement you sign with Obama is not worth the paper it's printed on, because a further president can simply rip it up. There's no entrenchment through the U.S. Constitution or through the U.S. public law framework of an executive agreement made between the president and another state or another or a foreign power. And secondly, in fact, even Congress can tear up an agreement that it has approved. A subsequent Congress can tear it up. Now, there was no mention significantly of international law in the letter. And the letter, as far as it went, highly misleading, was in some sense true. It's true that such agreements are not, as it were, constitutionalized in American, domestic law, so that you could go to court and prevent a subsequent president from saying that they're abrogating such an agreement. But Zarif and other spokespeople for Iran said that whatever the situation under the domestic or municipal law of the United States, they were looking for an agreement that would be binding in international law. And if it were binding in international law, that would satisfy their concerns. Now, this raised the whole question of whether the administration was, in fact, purporting to bind the U.S. in international law. You can see now that we're getting a lot of law into this. The administration backtracked and said that it was only negotiating a quote-unquote political agreement with Iran, not one that would be binding as a treaty. Now, why did they backtrack? Because had they said treaty, the agreement would have had to have been presumably approved by a procedure in the United States Constitution that would involve ratification by a supermajority of the U.S. Senate. So they were, and then there was, now you could also probably make an agreement binding in international law as a sole executive agreement or a congressional executive agreement, but a congressional executive agreement also requires, as the name implies, a certain level of support, at least majority support, in both houses of Congress. So what was the reaction to the letter? Basically, many people who had not paid attention to the issue were absolutely furious that Senator Cotton and these other senators were running interference with the administration's handling of diplomatic negotiations with Iran. There was even a movement that got a petition with 200,000 signatures to prosecute Tom Cotton and perhaps the other senators for violations of the Logan Act, which was an 18th century statute that made it an offense for an unauthorized American to interfere with U.S. diplomatic negotiations with foreign powers. Apparently, there was only no one was ever actually prosecuted and convicted under the Logan Act. There was one indictment against a Kentucky farmer who apparently had published an article in a European newspaper arguing for a kind of a breakaway state in the Midwest of the United States that would essentially be annexed to France. I have no idea why this was ever proposed, but I think they probably decided that it wasn't worth going ahead with the prosecution because this gentleman clearly did not pose any real threat to to American security. Prosecution was extreme, but I think the administration was quite right not to proceed with that. What happened was that the focus was very much on what was clearly a misstep and considered to be an insult to the to the administration. Then the debate unfolded, and the opponents of the agreement scored some successes. They got Henry Kissinger and George Shultz to come out against the agreement, and many former admirals, generals, secretaries of state came out on both sides. Opinions were mixed and not even necessarily divided along partisan lines. Brent Scowcroft, Admiral Scowcroft, Colin Powell, both who served in Republican administrations, for example, came out in support of the agreement. But then, you know, just around the time that the Kissinger and Shultz piece came out, which I thought would be probably influential, Tom Cotton managed to make another gross mistake. And that mistake was, he said in an interview, it would take only 3 days of bombing, essentially, for the U.S. to effectively do the job and destroy Iran's nuclear capacity. And this statement really fed into the approach of the administration. The approach of the Obama administration was to say that there are only two options here, diplomacy or war. So if you're opposed to this agreement, you have to reckon with the consequences. You have to take responsibility for an eventual war of the United States with Iran, because it's only the U.S. that actually could effectively do the job. And essentially, the administration argued, these are the same people who were telling you to go to war with Iraq before, with the consequences that necessarily followed. And what they said back then was that it would be done in a few days, there would be very few losses, it would be a surgical intervention, and the quote-unquote problem would go away. And so, you know, after what happened, are you really going to believe them today? This fundamentally undermined what had become the predominant strategy of the opponents, which was to argue that there's a better deal out there. Why don't we just hold firm, keep the sanctions on for a longer period of time, see how the political situation evolves in Iran. It's too early to make an agreement that legitimizes a regime that still is a destabilizing force in the region, that still has a terrible human rights record, supports terrorism internationally, and so on. It's not wrong, they said, these kinds of opponents said, that the U.S. is pursuing negotiations. That's right, we need to pursue negotiations, we need to keep the military option as the last resort, but we are not yet ready, and Iran is not yet ready for the kind of deal that would actually be a good deal and contribute significantly to enhanced peace and security in the region. And again, as somebody who supported the deal, I have to say that I have some respect for that position. I don't think it's an entirely unreasonable position, and you can read the military and scientific facts in a way that gives some plausibility to that kind of position. The next move of the opponents, however, was to try and get Congress to block the president's negotiation of the final deal. The framework agreement had come out, which stated the basic principles or parameters, and now the opponents, having failed to stop the framework agreement from being concluded, focused on interfering with the president's ability through Congress interfering with the president's ability to negotiate the final deal. This ultimately resulted in an act of Congress that said that, okay, we're going to give the president, you know, full room to maneuver to negotiate, and therefore ended up respecting the president's right to negotiate with foreign powers without having his or her hands tied by Congress. But then Congress would be given 60 days after it had received the final text of the agreement, you know, to, if it so chose, vote a resolution of disapproval. And the legal consequences and political consequences of such a resolution were not spelled out in any detail. The implication was that if the resolution of disapproval went through, that that the president would have no further legitimacy to take the measures necessary to implement the deal. And this brings us to back to sanctions and what I call the background or default legal rules that played a lot of a lot of the behind the scenes role in determining this outcome. So there are some sanctions that the president could remove without further action or approval by Congress. These were sanctions that Congress had delegated the authority to the president to remove. If therefore to stop the president from removing those sanctions would involve new legislation in Congress. And that legislation would be subject to the presidential veto, which is in turn subject to an override of a supermajority two-thirds in Congress. So basically, as long as President Obama had one-third in the House or the Senate, he could essentially stop a new congressional measure that would prevent him from lifting sanctions that Congress had previously delegated to him the authority to remove if he so chose. On the other hand, at the end of the day, if Iran wanted complete sanctions relief, and we're talking only nuclear sanctions, it was clear that human rights and anti-terrorism sanctions would remain. If Iran wanted complete relief from the nuclear-related sanctions, then Congress, and indeed the states, would eventually have to act down the line at some point. And that would involve new legislation in Congress, which would have to be passed by a majority of both houses. And there, obviously, that would be much more difficult, essentially impossible under the current configuration in Congress, for the president to sustain. Now, I don't think the Iranians were naive at all about the political realities in the United States. So the interesting question is, why were they able to sign a final deal where it was made very clear what sanctions could be lifted by the president on implementation day, assuming that Congress did not pass a veto-proof law preventing Obama from doing it, and what sanctions would require down the road the approval of Congress and or action by state governments. If you read the JCPOA, the plan of action, you can see it's actually set out quite clearly. Nobody is fooling anybody about what the president has authority to deliver as opposed to what one needs a positive approval or consent of Congress or the president, or Congress or the states to approve. That's very clear in the agreement. But it's also fairly clear that the law giving Congress the right to give a resolution of disapproval was in fact a major victory for the president, because Cotton and many of the others who were adamantly opposed to any agreement wanted to put all kinds of conditions on the negotiations, such as that Iran recognize the existence of the state of Israel, or conditions related to human rights that had nothing to do with nuclear safety, and conditions about verification, which would have essentially meant that the U.S. would have round-the-clock instant access to every possible location in Iran. Essentially, it would amount to saying the U.S. could come and occupy Iran. So all the efforts to do this were defeated, because most of the legislators wanted to make a basic point that we get a say in this. They were more concerned to make a statement that they would get a say and to have the president not veto or try to veto that legislation than to get all these conditions which the real opponents or the hardline opponents of the deal wanted to impose. So basically, a free hand to negotiate and then a vote up or down. And of course, subject to the presidential veto power, such that if there were a resolution of disapproval, all that would be required is for Obama to have a third in order to sustain his presidential veto. So given how that panned out, it actually started to look pretty good for the administration. But I think the sanctions story is also a story of why Iran agreed to a document that basically accepted that the president himself had limited powers, and that ultimately having all the sanctions removed would be dependent upon later congressional action. And here, I think what's really important, and which was underappreciated by the opponents, was the significance of having agreement entrenched in a UN Security Council resolution. People like Tom Cotton have nothing but contempt for the UN, and I don't think they know very well or very much about how it works or doesn't work. So let's take a scenario, which is the one that was being threatened by the Tom Cotton letter, that a subsequent administration pulls out. Or let's take a scenario that there's a resolution of disapproval. The question then is, what would happen with the other powers who had signed the agreement? Would they then say, okay, the US Congress doesn't like this agreement, so we're giving up on diplomacy with Iran and we're maintaining sanctions that are domestic, economic, and commercial interests are already pressing us very strongly to have removed. No, the likelihood was going to be, the almost certainty was going to be, that the U.S. would simply fight itself on the outside, that sanctions would be removed or at least lessened by the other countries, that that the legitimacy of a military alternative would be less than ever, in the sense that only the U.S. Congress was what stood in the way of successful diplomacy. But for other states to be able to remove their sanctions when Iran came to implementation day, it was necessary to change the Security Council resolution, because the Security Council resolution, and this is one of the main reasons that these sanctions are effective, it's very hard to maintain a common front with sanctions. There's a great political scientist, Lisa Martin at Harvard, who's written a book about this called Collective Coercion. It's very hard to do. Obama achieved it through strengthening sanctions and locking the strengthened sanctions in through the Security Council mechanism, something that people like Cotton and the neocons think is rubbish. But here, they were hoisted by their own petard. Because what they didn't think of was that of putting in that bill, as far as I know, or maybe it was defeated, but I don't think they ever made a real campaign to put in the bill a provision that said the president shall not endorse, through approval of a Security Council resolution, this agreement until it is reviewed by Congress. So what happens in July, before the congressional review starts? I think it's July. Maybe I've got the timing a little wrong. Somebody may correct me. But certainly before Congress has the chance to review the bill, lo and behold, there's a Security Council resolution endorsing it. And what does the Security Council resolution say? It says that the UN sanctions framework shall be removed with various qualifications and limits, but fundamentally removed once we get to implementation day, which is the day at which, by which Iran has been certified to have taken a certain specific set of steps towards full implementation of the agreement. So basically, the U.S. Congress could do what it wanted. On implementation day, if Iran and the other powers agreed, one would move forward with the agreement, and there would be authority in the Security Council resolution for the removal of the basic overall framework obliging members of the United Nations to impose and enforce these sanctions. So basically, once the Security Council resolution was passed, the political options were very different, right? The political options were not that the United States could, or the Congress could basically tank the entire Iran deal. More likely, the United States would become an outlier and isolated. Iran would get very significant sanctions relief, and the U.S. would be largely disempowered from trying to persuade its allies and other states to abandon this diplomatic solution and be open to an eventual solution, quote unquote, of the Iran nuclear question by the use of force. And so it's not surprising that one by one, apart from a fairly small group, the Democratic senators started to line, and Congress people started to line up with the administration. And by August, my sense is that Obama was sufficiently confident that he decided that he would score an intellectual victory, not just a political victory against the opponents. And he gave a speech at American University, and I'm running out of time because I want to allow a lot of time for discussion, so I'm not going to really read to you from that speech. But essentially he said that, you know, there's a long history in American foreign policy, and he cited Kennedy. He cited both Republican and Democratic administrations that had negotiated arms control treaties with the Soviets and so on, of maintaining military strength, but also trying to keep one's powder dry, trying to have recourse first to diplomacy, keenly aware of the risks and consequences of war and their gravity. In a line that rose almost to Thucydidean and eloquence in this speech, Obama made the statement, "The only certainty in war is human suffering," which is kind of a beautiful line. Then Obama said, "There were the people who brought you Iraq. They have a different view. They have a view that anybody who prefers diplomacy is an appeaser. They will tell you that military force can be projected with minimal harmful consequences, at least to America and Americans. They will tell you that using military force enhances a sense of America's strength and determination in the world." And they told you all of this at the time of the Iraq War, and you had to ask, do you believe them now, or do you want instead to consider yourself part of this other stronger, you know, more sensible and implicitly predominant tendency in American foreign policy. And I think what he was essentially suggesting was that the neocon view was a marginal view. Now, I think he sanitized the history of American foreign policy. I mean, you know, Kennedy got the U.S. into Vietnam, and what about, you know, overturning the Allende regime in Chile? So it was an oversimplification and a kind of sanitation. But to make the point that neoconservatism is not the core of the American foreign policy tradition. It's really a kind of aberration, that an exceptionalism that might not have had any purchase in actual policies after the Cold War ended, but for the psychic and other wounds that were inflicted on Americans at the time of 9/11. I think now that in fact, the neocons are pretty defeated. After the Iran fiasco. The deal is going forward. There were some last-ditch efforts to suggest that one could hold it up in the courts on the grounds that the agreements between the IAEA and Iran were not disclosed to Congress, some kind of tendentious legal argument that they're part of the Iran deal itself and their non-disclosure voids the process that the Congress undertook to consider a resolution of disapproval. But those efforts were soon abandoned, I think in part because Netanyahu, ultimately being a pragmatic politician and not liking to be a loser, decided that he himself wanted to move on to other issues, and in fact was forced by many events to have to move on to other issues. My only hope is that not too many of the neocons, when they decamp from the Beltway in D.C., end up misinforming students about Leo Strauss in colleges and universities.
Fantastic. So we have 30, 35 minutes for questions, and I propose that we take, in groups of three or four. So can I invite questions, comments, reflections from the room? Thank you.
In your speech, from what I understood, there was some kind of, let's say, taking advantage of the separation of power systems in the U.S. And I would like to ask you, had the U.S. had a different system, like, for example, the one in the U.K., would the legislative branch have so much power over the executive in foreign policy decision-making?
I'm unable to answer that question because I don't know enough about, the constitutional other rules in the UK system about the negotiation and approval of international agreements. But certainly there are lots of systems where, the legislative approval is relatively weak. So, the question, but here one has to be careful because the legal situation in the United States itself has a kind of murkiness to it. I mean, many legal scholars would argue that the president has a certain power to enter into internationally binding agreements as executive agreements without the approval of Congress, and there's some Supreme Court jurisprudence about that, and it's not unlimited, and it has to be related to some core areas of presidential responsibility. But of course, national security of this kind, involving nuclear proliferation, would be one of those core areas. But I think that at the end of the day, there was. Many people were relieved that this remains somewhat murky because there are hundreds of these executive agreements. Professor Una Hathaway, who's a very fine academic at Yale Law School, has written some articles about this. There are many, many of these agreements on important issues. And if it turned out to be the case that these were done in a way inconsistent with the executive's constitutional authority, there would be very significant negative consequences that would have to be faced.
Great. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
So I was just wondering if you could respond a little bit to some of the critiques of the actual agreement in particular. What do you think will happen if there's not compliance? And then with respect to the 15 years, do you think there were different fact sheets produced by the U.S. and by the Iranian government after in terms of what the agreement meant, and there surely will be differences in interpretation down the road that once it's formally implemented, there'll be certainly claims and counterclaims. So what do you have a sense in terms of the P5 and the Security Council now, what position they would be in to introduce new sanctions, whether or not compliance?
Yes, there's a provision in the agreement called snapback, which basically provides for the automatic return of the basic Security Council sanctions framework if there are serious violations by Iran of the agreement, which of course goes to how that's to be determined. And the agreement doesn't have a kind of, well, you and I are very familiar with WTO, but any kind of really judicial or quasi-judicial dispute settlement mechanism. So if there's a fundamental dissensus about whether Iran is in serious violation, the agreement is likely to break down because you would have the snapback, and the snapback also entitles Iran to limit its own performance of its obligations. So whether, the agreement is performed or not, I think is very much dependent upon geopolitical realities, the dynamics of internal politics in Iran. I would say to the critics of the agreement that it's hard to see how we would be better off, without the agreement. It's hard to see that having the agreement is going to make the unpalatable military option more likely, as opposed to less. Was it plausible to believe that if you had more or tougher sanctions than you had, that Iran would simply, you know, surrender its sovereignty and, you know, and agree to a deal that either basically, in effect, denied it a right to a civilian, effective civilian nuclear program. I'm not an expert on internal politics in Iran, but, you know, just in terms of how I believe that sovereign states behave, I think that's an extremely unlikely chance. So the better agreement theory seems to me to be one that has a lot of implausibility, you know, to it. Is there some specific criticism that you're interested in my responding to that I haven't responded, because I'd be happy to address it?
What I understand is two things. One, if I go back to Security Council to make a decision as to the non-implementation, to the extent that the sanctions could apply, be applied by the entire world once more. And that each individual member, though, would also retain the option to interpret itself whether or not there's been non-compliance.
Well, that's the feature of SNAPback that's so unusual, in that essentially the permanent members of the Security Council agree in advance to give up their veto. So in effect, you know, if there's a determination, you know, of serious non-compliance, then the return is automatic. It's not required to get, you know, a positive vote of the council that is not subject to vetoes. But of course, the determination of serious violation is where you could have, you know, a breakdown, and the question is really, will the agreement put both Iran and its interlocutors on a different path where, you know, sanctions relief works out, it improves the Iranian, you know, economy, where, you know, the political regime in Iran sees a lot of advantages in complying, you know, with the agreement. I would be the last person to say that I have the real competence to predict, you know, how politics will emerge in Iran. I myself was critical of the overstated expectations of some supporters of the agreement that one could be sure that this was a turnaround in relations with Iran and its behavior in the region, and the strong impetus to, or a lever to, make Iran a more responsible player and, you know, dealing, you know, with regional issues. I think, you know, my own support for the agreement was, in a way, a very cautious and conservative support that you know, it offered important, you know, safeguards and limitations, and bought a considerable period of time to see whether we could go on a different path or whether Iran would go on a different path.
Rob, can I ask you to speculate just a little bit on the strength of the support of the other members of the permanent five for the deal? So I guess you told a story, which of course has to be right, that the administration was strengthened in its position in U.S. domestic politics by the strength of the support from the other partners to the agreement. Can you say a bit more about where that support comes from? What are the key interests driving it, and more particularly, what you think it would take to fracture that support or unravel it?
Yes. I'm glad you raised this, because you know, had I had more time, I would have talked about you know, another episode that actually was, you know, apparently had some influence on the support among U.S. legislators, which is that the administration brought, you know, senior officials from the other members, you know, and particularly from Europe, to talk to members of Congress, senators, and, you know, basically to tell them that we fully support this, we're determined to implement it, and we're determined, you know, to lift sanctions if Iran complies. And so it made extremely credible, you know, the basic story that, you know, the main result of congressional disapproval
will be, the U.S. will be isolated, the sanctions regime will collapse, you know, anyway. I mean, not American sanctions. And then, you know, what Senator Schumer, who was one of the big opponents of the deal, and others said, well, we will deal with that by imposing new and stronger secondary sanctions, which means that if other countries and their businesses deal with Iran, we will punish them by cutting them off from the U.S. economy and financial system. And you know, Treasury Secretary Liu and the president himself, in that speech I referred to at American University, basically said, you know, that, I mean, that's a fantasy that you're going to cut China off from the U.S. financial system when we're, you know, when they have money. You know, when we're borrowing some money from them, and American businesses are totally, you know, dependent on their supply chains. I mean, you just can't do that kind of thing and not, you know, significantly injure American commercial interests as well as you know, political relations with the countries concerned. And in fact, you know, in one blog post, I linked this issue of secondary sanctions to TTIP and questioned, you know, whether, you know, even under an investor-state arbitration or investor protection law, there might be significant liabilities for, you know, the United States if it imposed these kinds of secondary sanctions on businesses that qualified as investors or investments in the United States.
Further comments, questions? Yeah.
Thanks very much for that, Rob. I was just wondering, you're talking at the end of Obama's speech and the construction of neoconservatism as a sort of an aberration in American foreign policy and a fairly recent one. I was wondering, though, given that there are still all these neoconservative advisors seated in, you know, various of the American Republican primary candidates' foreign policy advice teams, as you mentioned also even within Hillary Clinton's team, leaving the Iran issue aside, which they clearly had a setback, to what extent do you think that the sort of neo-Obama position retains either a current strength or the potential for resurgence in relation to lots of other kind of international conflicts, so in relation to ISIS, in relation to Syria?
Well, that's an excellent and very helpful question. So I think that the ISIS in Syria is a really good illustration of a reason why the neocons, it seems to me, are fated to decline, if not fizzle out almost entirely, which is, you know, they can go gangbusters, you know, criticizing the Obama administration for weakness and mistakes and so on, but ultimately, they themselves don't come across as credible in saying that they have a solution, you know, to these problems. I mean, Bill Kristol's statement was the perfect statement. You know, what to do with, about ISIS? Let's bomb them for a few weeks and see what the situation looks like after we bomb them for a few weeks. And, you know, this is, for better or for worse, one experiment that we've done, not necessarily, you know, following Kristol, and so, you know, the idea, I mean, they basically have a sword without a strategy, and so these complicated issues like Syria, ISIS, they don't have clear answers to. Their only answer is more troops, more bombing, but I think that people, you know, there's a credibility gap. People see more bombing and so on, and more advisors, and they don't see that as solving the problem. And the neocons don't have any, you know, more of a magic bullet to offer than that kind of just heavy-handed a prescription. So I think that's another difficulty that they have, which is leading to their relative, you know, insignificance. You know, their significance has been in part, you know, propped up by, you know, a random fact, and I'm sure there are some people who regard this as not random, or I mean, certainly maybe neo-Marxists, whatever, that there happen to be some huge funders, donors in American politics, like Sheldon Adelson, who share that, you know, that perspective. And so, you know, it's easy to get money if you're a Republican candidate who is willing to bring in those kinds of advisors. But I think this episode is an illustration that in the area of foreign policy, maybe it's not the same in other areas, but in the area of foreign policy, just throwing money at it, it is not necessarily going to translate into political influence. Because let's face it, a lot of these neocons, and I mean, choosing Tom Cotton to be the point man in the opposition to the Iran deal, these are people who fundamentally lack political judgment. I mean, during the Cold War, some of them really did come out of intelligence and RAND, and they knew something about missiles and silos, and they could claim to have some range of genuine, technical information. I mean, Wolfowitz, one of the key architects of the Iraq War, was falsely claimed to have been trained by Leo Strauss. I mean, he took audited, of course, by Strauss, but he did his PhD with Albert Wohlstetter, who was the kind of Dr. Strangelove nuclear strategist out of the RAND Corporation, who believed that the U.S. could, with the right technologies and strategies, win a nuclear war against the Soviet Union. But, it sounds crazy, but at least Wohlstetter, was a mathematical genius. He had the numbers and, he played the war games and so on. The ones that are, lurking around Washington today, have little to offer except rhetoric. They can't cast their views very much in terms of actual expertise about ISIS, where it comes from, and so on. So one of the sources of their legitimacy in the Cold War period is kind of not present anymore. The legitimacy really hinges on calling other people appeasers and Neville Chamberlains, and kind of they're self-identifying themselves with Winston Churchill standing up against Hitler. And there's only so far you can take that.
Thanks very much for the talk. What is your geopolitical prognosis of the agreement for the Middle East as a region?
So my angle for this talk is I know something about sanctions, and I know something about ideas in foreign policy and American foreign policy. But I'm not giving this talk as in kind of posing as or an instant expert on the Middle East. But I'll give you what I think is what I sense the president's expectation is. I think the president sees the region as a really awful mess now, and that this agreement seems to take off the table an immediate possibility or risk of something that will make the place even worse, which would be a military confrontation between Israel and possibly the United States and Iran over its nuclear program. So by taking that off the table, ideally for at least 15 years, if not forever, you actually manage or reduce one of many, many risks. I don't see the president as having the expectations that some very idealistic supporters of the agreement have, that somehow this will change the political path of Iran. This will turn it into a responsible rather than irresponsible regional player, and so forth. But I do think that the president sees the region as a very dangerous place, that there are a lot of conflicts to which no clear short or even medium or long-term answer is apparent. So taking off the table for possibly a considerable period of time one possible source of exacerbated conflict that could have broader negative consequences is a positive achievement. In terms of Obama's foreign policy legacy, I think it's arguable that the opening to Cuba may be more important, ultimately for America's interests hemispheric strength and an image in the hemisphere. I wouldn't overplay the Iran agreement as a centerpiece, but I do think that the same kind of what one would call anti-neocon approach, engagement and negotiation rather than demonization and aggressiveness, that reflects the philosophy that Obama outlined in his speech on Iran at American University, is also present in the opening to Cuba.
I'd like to ask about what you talked about the neocon movement within the Republican Party, and what you think, and you described it as being on a relative decline since, I suppose, 73. I want to ask you what you consider the role of the neocon movement within the Republican Party today and in the near future, in the context of the rise of the fiscal hawks, in the House Freedom Caucus, within the, well, much expanded congressional Republican delegation. Since historically Republicans were opposed to bigger government except for that very big chunk of military spending, but these fiscal hawks are actually opposed even to greater military spending. So in terms of foreign policy, do you think the Republican Party is moving away from neoconservatives and towards a less interventionist approach?
Well, what's clear is that the neocons have spent a lot of resources fighting not necessarily liberals but people like Ron Paul and others who are in favor of isolationism, but also, as you point out, why should the U.S. spend money to protect the world as opposed to just ourselves? And so they're fighting those battles. The real question is there within the Republican Party any kind of middle way, between the neocon type hawk position on the one hand and the isolationist kind of narrow American interest provision on the other? And there are some people who think that it's going to be very tough for the Republican Party if it doesn't develop a reasonable position about America's engagement with the world. It may be a less quote-unquote liberal position, it may have more hawkish elements and more reliance on military strength than a comparable position by a liberal candidate in the Democratic Party, but still it would be broadly consistent with a kind of mainstream tradition of American foreign policy characterized by Obama. Leadership and engagement without unilateralism and gratuitous aggression and knee-jerk resort to military force or the use of threat of the threat of the use of force. I'm part of an initiative, and our report is coming in soon, to develop bipartisan principles of American foreign policy. In other words, to see whether there's some kind of center of American foreign policy. I do think that the neocons are kind of outside of that center. That doesn't mean that I like everything that's been within that center over the last 50 or much less 250 years. But this effort is of considerable interest to Republicans as well as some Democrats who find themselves more in the middle of the road. So we have Republicans and Democrats who are sitting on this. On this initiative, and I think that the final report is not public, but I would be surprised if it doesn't contain, and again, this is a bipartisan initiative, some bipartisan statement that the use of force be regarded as a last resort, that would be a general axiom of American foreign policy, and that in itself would be a kind of, if you buy the idea that this report is genuinely bipartisan, it would be kind of a repudiation of the neocon view of better to use force earlier than later and better to use more force than less. But we'll see. As I say, the report is not public, so this is kind of a speculation on one of the principles that it may actually contain.
Further thoughts and comments?
Okay, I ask one question. Sir, Israel's inability to stop this deal, in spite of Mr. Netanyahu being allowed to come and address Congress, is this likely to affect the future of Israel's role in American politics?
Well, I would say two things. One is that, you know, Netanyahu is doing his best to limit the damage on his political career, and limiting the damage is moving on and not keeping coming back to it, and so, you know, I think that that's had some influence on you know, the neocons, who are very sore losers. I mean some people actually block me on Twitter after. You know, they're very sore losers, but I think, you know, I think Netanyahu has probably tried to convince them, like, I don't like to appear as a loser, why should you? So let's move on. I mean, there were some people who thought, and some of them, you know, I would say anti-Israel, and maybe even anti, you know, Jewish, that what would happen is that the American Jewish community would kind of see this as an existential issue for Israel, and simply, follow Netanyahu. And that clearly, you know, didn't happen. The organized Jewish community was deeply divided in the United States. The polls suggested that there was a larger percentage of Jews than non-Jews among the American populace who actually supported the agreement. And so, it seems to me that what this reflected was that Netanyahu had a much too great estimate of his ability to kind of be seen as the leader, you know, of Jews worldwide, who they would have to follow regardless of, you know, the arguments for and against. And you know, when people like the former, you know, heads of the Shin Bet and the Mossad and the leading nuclear scientist and military officer responsible for nuclear issues in Israel over many, many years and many governments came forward and said this is a good deal and it's essentially blocking all the pathways we know to a bomb, undermine Netanyahu's authority. These were not partisan people. I mean, they had served in governments representing very different political parties and positions, and they had been responsible collectively for Israel's security for decades. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think probably there's a considerable amount of finger pointing about how much tension and conflict was introduced by the effort by Netanyahu and his American friends to sort of, you know, force people to, you know, to support this on the basis that, you know, if you didn't support this, you didn't support Israel, and that was something that was not good if you were Jewish not to support Israel. I mean, it really, you know, the community was divided. It was heavily debated. And I think that, because people respect each other, those divisions will be eventually overcome. But I think that one thing about that became clear is that Israelis and Americans, including American Jews, like to think for themselves and don't like to be told, you know, what they have to do or think, and that if they don't do or think something, that they're bad people or they've betrayed themselves or betrayed their identity and so on. And that's a strategy that I think is unlikely to be tried again in the near future.
Okay, well, I think it's time for us to wrap this up. Rob, if you've lost...
There's
one more. Okay, yeah. Sorry, don't worry. I'm fine.
Just a quick one. The agreement itself has different terminology in respect of the lifting of sanctions between the EU and the US. So it says the EU will terminate all provisions of the EU regulation implementing the EU sanctions, but with the US it says the US will cease the application of these sanctions. What's the reason for the difference in terminology that's due to the different mechanisms?
Yes, because exactly. So this goes back to something that I mentioned earlier, and I'm delighted that you've given me the opportunity to clarify it, which is that the U.S. sanctions have their basis in the in congressional legislation, and because it would be very difficult to get this Congress to take positive action to lift the legislative framework, Iran has signed onto the deal based upon the notion that there are enough sanctions, significant enough sanctions, that can be lifted pursuant to the president's discretion to lift them, which is the reference to application. The president, these are the subset of sanctions where even though the sanctions are based in legislation, the legislation itself gives the president the authority to decide whether they're to be applied or not to be applied, and that's the difference. Yes.
Yeah. I would be a Republican and Democratic debate and absolute majority, like Hillary and Trump and Jeb Bush mentioned that the greatest international threat to US is the threat of nuclear Iran. So I just wanted to ask you, as the American citizen.
I'm not, by the way. I have a green card.
Oh.
I hope that doesn't delegitimize me in giving this talk. But Kissinger was an immigrant, maybe didn't immediately get. Well, he did, I think, get citizenship quite quickly. Yeah.
But is it really the case? Because what's about Russia? What about North Korea, ISIS, Syria, and things like that? So do you really think that the question of Iran is the most important question on the U.S. Agenda?
No.
As for now.
No, I don't. And so there was a lot of opinion polling that suggested that the majority of the U.S. population never at any point supported the Iran deal. And then there was opinion polling where people were given I think arguably a reasonably neutral briefing about the Iran deal. And that public opinion polling resulted in a small majority in favor of the deal. But my point here is that I actually don't think that most people thought a lot about this. It meant a great deal to some people. And it probably means a great deal to some very important donors to, presidential, campaigns. Trump being the exception because he's financing his own campaign. But, I wouldn't pay much attention to, to his analysis of the geopolitical situation. Of course, that I may live to regret that if he actually one day becomes president, saying that. But I don't think it's based upon any deep analysis. In the case of Jeb Bush, he actually, if you look back on his statements, kind of flip flopped on this issue, a bit, is that something that Clinton also said, that
yeah,
that it was the most serious threat to,
nuclear Iran.
I personally don't, I don't think that. I mean, it seems to me that, that there are, that instability, even instability in China, is probably ultimately more serious, poses more serious risk to the United States than Iran gets a nuclear weapon. I mean, ultimately, as President Obama said, if they weaponize and show aggressive intent, the U.S. will have more capacity to address that decisively in 10 years' time than we do, you know, now. But, you know, we could do it if we absolutely had to do it. We could set it back, you know, a number of years. It's much harder to imagine, you know, how we would address the consequences of China becoming destabilized, or a civil war in Russia, or the assassination of Putin. I mean, you know, some weeks or months ago, Putin disappeared. I think he went on a trip with one of his girlfriends, as it turned out. But people got really worried that maybe he had been assassinated. And you can imagine, you know, that, you know, the way in which he's kind of held together that country as an oligarchy / plutocracy, then all bets would be off. And, you know, there's huge amounts of nuclear material of all kinds, nuclear scientists, nuclear weapons in various states of repair or disrepair. So, I mean, it's almost inconceivable that these scenarios would be much more frightening and much more difficult to figure out how we would manage them than, you know, because even though I don't agree with Tom Cotton that, you know, that, you know, we can make it disappear with 3 days of bombing, at least we do have the means, if we absolutely had to at the last resort, to, you know, to get rid of the threat for a period of years, albeit I think at a considerable cost, not the kind of cost that, you know, Cotton was thinking of, which is, you know, apparently minimal. But still, I mean, I think these other risks are greater. I don't like the language of threat. I prefer the language of risk, because I think when we talk about threat, we always think about, oh, there are all these enemies out there. I don't necessarily regard Russia as an enemy or China. These are complex places that have current policies and future vulnerabilities that could greatly harm, you know, our interests, but also great potential. But there are serious risks of you know, that we need to manage, and I think they're, in a way, harder to manage, and the stakes are even higher than with the Iran nuclear program. Yes? This will have to be the last question. I'm sorry.
Okay, great. I am the last question. So, earlier in the Q&A session, you have mentioned that there is two pillars of the Obama strategy, just like the leadership and the engagement. The plan of action has to demonstrate it. And with that, I agree, it was a real leadership that has been demonstrated in terms of the action. But I have difficulties in terms of understanding the engagement part that the plan action demonstrates. Because so far as, in my understanding of the plan, what has been offered to Iran is just temporary lifting up of the sanctions. Because as far as I understand, the sanctions will stay there, and they can come back at any time, so it's just, they will be like swinging like the Democrats' board. So, are there any other engagement measures that has been envisioned within the action plan, or any other sort of dimensions of the U.S. foreign policy?
Absolutely. There's going to be major cooperation, not just with the U.S., but with the others of the P5 plus one in modifying Iran's nuclear program to allow it to have a viable civilian nuclear program, while, you know, imposing safeguards, you know, to prevent a breakout to a nuclear weapon. That's not something that Iran is just running off and doing, and then, you know, the rest of us will judge them. I mean, there's going to be lots of cooperation, lots of meetings, lots of, you know, help. You know, in fact, one of the provisions involves, you know, interim lifting of those sanctions that might be necessary to bring the material into Iran so that you can do the necessary modifications and switcharounds in the nuclear program. So, you know, this is an agreement that envisages hands-on technical collaboration between Iran and the countries that signed the agreement. I think also the negotiation itself represents an engagement of sorts. I mean, when you consider where the relationship between Iran and the United States was before, you know, Kerry and Zarif sat down together, The fact that they sat down together for days and had bilaterals and spent hours trying to work these things out, you know, in an atmosphere of relative calm and respect. I mean, I consider it, maybe that's minimal, maybe that you could call that pre-engagement, but it certainly suggests a shift towards, away from demonization and isolation.
Well, it sounds like you lost some neocon Twitter followers, but I guess you gained some tonight, so please join.